What is exciting about the 1960s is that it was a time of profound questioning. And these questions that people were asking, that the left was asking, were being fueled by the war in Vietnam, both the brutality of the way that the US were carrying it out and also because they were losing it. They were being fueled by racism toward African Americans, but also because of the civil rights movement that posed a challenge to it. And they were fueled by unfulfilled expectations. And what I mean by that is that the economic expansion during the post-war boom brought with it a number of contradictions. For example, Italy and France, which I'm going to look at later on, both countries transformed their economies, and yet French workers were the worst paid in Europe. And for Italian workers, many of which had moved from off their farms in the south to the cities in the north, expecting to find work and a better life perhaps, were shunted into cities with an appalling housing crisis that couldn't deal with the population explosion, and were shunted into the most menial and worst paid jobs. And a lot of their hostility at their situation that they found themselves in was brought into the politics in the workplace. The expansion of the university system also led to unfulfilled expectations. Students from lower middle class and working class backgrounds for the first time had access to university, and yet when they turned up, the explosion in numbers in the student population was not there was not the commensurate amount of building and infrastructure to meet their needs either. And so students felt that they were attending and part of a degree factory rather than an educational institution. And that fueled a lot of the student movement's actions right around the world. And you would find again and again the issues in wider society would impinge on those actions as well. Just one example to give you a sense of that. One of the first groups of students to take action in Italy in the 60s was architecture students. And they took action against their fairly incomprehensible and ancient lecturers, because the Italian education system was so outdated and very much still is today. As well. And they took action over the course content because they were sick of hearing about how the Tower of Pisa was built, how to build grand structures when there was a massive housing crisis in Italy, and they wanted to learn how they could do something to contribute to solving it. They thought their education should actually serve a purpose, and that was what drove them into action. And these actions in turn sparked new questions for people. They sparked questions about how to win, how to end the war in Vietnam, how to end racism, how to reshape the education system. But for a section of people that were the most active, they wanted to know, how can we take control of this mess and reorganise it in a way that's actually sensible? And this talk is largely looking at the answers that people found to those questions. And what I want to argue is that although the left tried to define its politics in contradistinction to the old left, to the failed politics of the Communist Party, they ended up being very much shaped by and plagued by these same politics that they sought to reject. Now, I want to look first of all at America, and if we're talking about America, we're talking about two groups that were at the forefront of the radicalisation in the 1960s, and that is American students and African Americans. I think many people amongst these two groups were fast coming to the conclusion that there was something fundamentally wrong with their society. Paul Potter, who was a leading member of Students for a Democratic Society, who was obviously a child of the 1950s, the Cold War period, describes the impact that the Vietnam War had had on his conception of the role that the US played in the world. He said, "Most of us grew up thinking that the US was a strong but moral nation that respected the integrity of other nations and other systems, that engaged in war as a last resort. And if some points, and if we began to hear some vague and disturbing things about what our country had done in Latin America or in China or Spain and elsewhere, we still felt confident about the basic integrity of our nation's foreign policy. But the war in Vietnam has provided the razor, the terrifyingly sharp cutting edge that has finally severed that last vestige of illusion that morality and democracy are the guiding principles of American foreign policy. The more we explore the war in Vietnam, the more we are driven to the conclusion that the US may well be the greatest threat to world peace in the world today. And I think that is symptomatic, or it articulates the shift that was going on in America at the time, a shift towards that led people toward much more radical ideas. And to give you a sense of that constituency, Fortune magazine carried out a survey of students in 1968 and found that 368,000 students identified as revolutionary. By 1970, that number had increased to 1 million. And amongst young black men aged under 21, 43% of them at this time supported the aims of the Black Panther Party, which I'll look at briefly in a moment. The Black Panthers, as well as Students for a Democratic Society, are good examples to look at because they both, I guess, were the organisational form that this radicalisation took. So if we look first at SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, its rise and fall were both dramatic, actually. In the space of 4 years, SDS grew from a membership that numbered 2,500 people nationally in 1965 to 100,000 nationally, with 400 different chapters around at university campuses around the country by its demise in 1969. Its growth very much reflected that they put themselves at the head of the student wing of the anti-war movement. They are responsible for mass mobilizations, 20,000 people in 1965, but the later one in 1968 mobilized 500,000 students against the war. But they were also very much a part of the civil disobedience actions and the teach-ins in the early part of the movement. But as well as this, they led many struggles on campus around the issues of people's education as well. But their demise reflected in one part the volatility that is inherent in the student movement, but more than that, much more than that, because that doesn't have to be fatal by any stretch, more than that, it reflected the politics that came to dominate the student movement. Now, at first, SDS posited itself as being non-ideological, and that reflected that the students were driven by moral indignation, and they didn't think that they needed ideas and politics to guide them. They believed that was enough, and it was a good start, but it was very much, they also were rejecting ideology on the basis of trying to reject everything that the old left had seemed to stand for. And by the old left, I'm talking about here the Communist Party. They were very much reacting against the conservatism of the Communist Party, the role that they had played in putting the brakes on struggle. They saw them as much into machine politics as, you know, wheeling and dealing as other political parties, and they viewed them as being anti-democratic and bureaucratic, all of which was true. But they also rejected out of hand as outdated the idea about the centrality of the class struggle and the role that the party can play as a weapon in that struggle. So instead, the new left defined itself as being anti-authoritarian rather than, that meant anti-establishment. But it also meant rejection of any kind of leadership as inherently authoritarian as well. Now, telling a demonstration of 50,000 people that there are no marshals here, that everybody can go where they want, actually did have a lot of appeal at a time when mass participation and where you could have mass meetings of hundreds, sometimes thousands of students participating in decision making, that had enormous appeal. Despite the fact that it wasn't very practical, because in that example, the demonstration of 50,000, when it was Daniel Cohn-Bendit, one of the leaders of the French May movement, that said it, in reality, the leading members, including himself, got together in a huddle and had to very quickly work out where the hell they were going to go. And so, and even if the student leaders aren't conscious of it, it does benefit the most vocal of them that end up making the decisions, in the end anyway. They emphasise that the character of the revolt would be spontaneous, and they emphasise the spontaneity to the exclusion of needing any sort of organisation to gear it. And, you know, again, you can understand as a reaction to seeing the way that the Communist Party had operated as putting the brakes on rather than guiding forth, the party to guide struggle, that, this could be a reaction. And they emphasise that the participants, the agent for change, were the masses, and that included students, and included high school students, and included returned soldiers, black people, gay people, homosexuals, homeless people. It included all these different groups, but you couldn't talk about class, and you couldn't talk about the relative power of these different groups. In fact, the working class were viewed as being bought off and complicit in the imperialist system. And so what it boiled down to was that the agent of change was anyone who was enlightened enough to measure up. Now, even though I've said the ideas of the New Left were born out of a reaction to the conservatism of the Communist Party, this conception of the world also fits for many students who have no sense of that legacy, no sense of that history, and it fits because of the student's own class position, which was that they have a lack of social power and that ideas are what they're dealing with in their day-to-day lives anyway. And so students are generally prone to thinking that the ideas of an individual is absolutely everything when it comes to change, and that they, as the most clever people, will be the ones that lead it. And yet, in 1968, towards the end of 1968, SDS goes through an about-face. Overnight, it seems, it embraces Marxism. What changed was that 1968 was the year of the French May, the year that where workers launched the biggest general strike in history to that date, that rocked an advanced capitalist country. It was the year of the Tet Offensive, when it became clear to everyone that the US was going to lose in Vietnam. And more than that, it was when the US ruling class upped the stakes, because they feared that even worse than losing in Vietnam, they stood to lose control on their home turf as well. And so the level of hysteria against the left generally was increased to a fever pitch. But more than that, there was serious repression, the brunt of which was borne by the black movement. And for many, many, many people, when Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 1968, this signaled to people that politics was no longer going to be conducted according to some polite set of rules. When people you know and you have worked with, people in the black community that you have association with, are being framed, are being jailed, and some of them being murdered in cold blood, politics became a matter of life and death for people. Now, as Jack Weinberg, who was a participant in SDS, said, he described that when the stakes were raised, our moral vision didn't seem enough anymore. He said, when we realised that we were up against the heaviest power structure in the world, that was when we sought more political definition. And the appeal of Marxism was that it was the most thoroughgoing theory of revolution. 1968, then, was a time when class struggle seemed relevant, and when the party seemed like a good strategy to combat the power of the state. These ideas started to make sense to a vast number of people, and it is precisely at these times that the revolutionary left can make a real running, can make real inroads. But the political current that came to define Marxism for that generation of activists was by and large the Maoists. Now, the Maoists were formed out of splits in the communist parties that were precipitated, that happened worldwide, and they were precipitated by the Sino-Soviet split, where China broke off foreign relations with Russia in response to its détente to the West. Now, the Chinese state could still retain a radical gloss because it seemed, unlike Russia, that they had not arrived on the world stage as a superpower. That, in fact, they were still a pariah. They were treated as such by the West, and in turn, Chairman Mao's rhetoric was very hostile to the West, and he talked about imperialism. And if you combine that with the success of the 1949 Chinese Revolution in booting out a foreign occupying power, the Chinese state still had enormous prestige in the eyes of those who, for whom the questions about imperialism mattered so much, and who were doing everything they could to defeat their own imperialist government. So China could seem radical in a way that it just doesn't today, and in a way that Russia didn't then either. But this was not the splits in the Communist Party that, you know, out of which the Maoists formed. They were not a fundamental break with Stalinism. They just had swapped idolization of one state with another. And so they carried with them all the distortions of Stalinism as to what socialism is all about. They gutted Marxism of its heart and soul. That is, they obscured from view Marx's insight that the liberation of the working class must be the act of the working class. In the model of the Chinese Revolution, it is not the conditions of capitalism that engender resistance from the working class, but the will of the revolutionaries, the will of the actions of the guerrillas, of a small band of an organized army that make the revolution. This is known as voluntarism, and one of the most popular ideas at the time was Che Guevara's call out that the highest act of a revolutionary is to make a revolution. And this fitted very much with the dedication of the students, and it fitted with their sense that revolution was just around the corner. But it actually isn't so different to their original view, that vested in an enlightened elite, the role and task of making a revolution. And secondly, they still, in this model of revolution where the guerrillas play the instigating role, and the working class in China played an essentially passive role, the role of the working class is viewed as secondary. So on the one hand, SDS increased its rhetoric about workers to a fever pitch almost in their material, but essentially it was an add-on. They redefined proletariat, for example, to include all of the different groups that the masses, you know, meant for them before. So there's still no real understanding about class. And when they talked about relating to workers, largely in practice, they went about imitating a crude stereotype of workers, because their project wasn't about trying to win over and seriously influence a section of political workers and trying to impact on their ideas through argument and debate. Instead, they were prepared, it wasn't about challenging that, so they adopted some of the, you know, most backward, what they, you know, as part of their, some of the most backward ideas. So, for example, instead of challenging prejudice when it came up, they adopted it. They subjected their women members to sessions that ran for days about self-criticism of their feminist politics. They denounced homosexuality as being a conspiracy to weaken workers and a product of the indulgence of capitalism. When it came to the Black Panthers, at first they tailed behind the Panthers' politics totally uncritically. They raised, you know, no attempt to try to argue and or try to influence through argument. And then they denounced the Panthers and Black nationalism as entirely reactionary. And thirdly, they Their model of a party was the Stalinist model of an anti-democratic, tightly controlled organization. People would read what is to be done and conclude that that was what Lenin had meant, the same sort of party model as the Communist Party itself. And so they still viewed Leninism as being associated with Stalin, but now this was actually treated as a virtue. And it was this set of politics that contributed to the fatal split of SDS in 1969 and destroyed the organisation only a year out from the biggest student strike, I think, in history, that involved 4 million students in response to the Kent State shooting in 1970. If we turn briefly to Black America and to the Panthers, Black nationalism was the political expression of the frustration people felt that the passage of the Civil Rights Bill in 1964 had changed so little, and the programs of Johnson's Great Society that were supposed to be about combating poverty were being dismantled to pay for the war. Now, I don't have time to go into a critique of Black nationalism, but suffice to say it was vague enough to mean many things to many people. But for one important section, for the Panthers, who had an influence of, well, one measure of it is that their paper sold 100,000 copies in 1968 on a weekly basis, not for the entirety of the year. For that section, Black power was a rejection of the US state as being fundamentally racist and warmongering, and with it, a rejection of the power structures of capitalism and an identification with socialism. But because of their influence and because they were the left wing of the movement, they were subject to the most insidious and repressive campaign that the CIA has ever launched on its own turf. And that's really saying something, because we are, after all, talking about the CIA. They framed many leading members, they jailed others, and they shot people in cold blood. The seriousness of the situation meant that the founding members, Huey Newton and Aldrich Cleaver and Bobby Seale, took questions of theory really seriously. But again, the hegemony that the Maoists had established on the left did not add any clarity to the questions that confronted them. For example, one of the problems that the Panthers had was that they oriented to the Black ghettos, which rather than the workplace, and that meant they had a disproportionate support amongst unemployed people, people that are more likely to eke out a living on petty crime and therefore are more susceptible to being bought off by the police. And so the organisation was susceptible to being infiltrated in a way that, by contrast, the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, Revolutionary Union Movement amongst Detroit workers, Detroit Black workers, never had the same sorts of problems. And yet Maoism did emphasise that it was the most oppressed, in the case of China, peasants, but that was interpreted to mean homeless people, the unemployed, in cities in America. And secondly, one of Mao's most famous sayings, that power comes out of a barrel of a gun, didn't do them much good either, because in the battle between the Panthers and the US state, it was pretty clear who had the most firepower. So Maoism hides from view that the real vulnerability that the capitalists have is that they're reliant on workers to produce everything they need in society and produce their profits. And it is the working class that has the power to take on the state. If we turn, though, to France and Italy, it is a contrast to America, because in these two examples, it was the working class that were at the forefront of the struggle against capitalism. And the ideas of the far left penetrated into its ranks. Both examples show as well the impact that the student movement can have on the workers' movement, both in terms of the ideas that the students were arguing, but also that their actions, if they cause enough of a headache, can then in turn spark action at a workplace level. In France, for example, in May of 68. It was after the night of barricades, the night that 50,000 students, but also by that stage, many young workers that had come down to see what the hell was going on, because this was a culmination of days of demonstrations that had mobilised tens of thousands, you know, in the previous week. And it was after this that, you know, after those people battled the cops throughout the entire evening, that students won the sympathy of workers en masse. And they won their support not because they were victims of police brutality, but because they had stood their ground. Because it seemed that finally people were standing up to the authoritarianism of General de Gaulle. And when the anger had gotten to such a point that the Communist Party-led trade unions could no longer ignore it, having denounced the students' actions only a week before, they actually had to call a general strike. Now, they hoped, fingers crossed, that this would be a once-off token demonstration that would head off any other actions. But the scale of the strike was so unprecedented that it gave workers a green light that they could take the struggle back to their workplace. And it took one workplace the next day for the strike to spread throughout France, to workplaces throughout France. And by the end of the week, 9 million workers were participating in an unofficial and unlimited general strike. And for a brief moment, it seemed as though it might be capable of toppling de Gaulle. What was on show to the world at this time was the strength that the working class have in an advanced capitalist country. But what was also on show was the treachery of the Communist Party. As I said, they denounced the students. In their paper, they published articles talking about how the student agitators were denying students the opportunity of sitting their exams and that they should all let us get on with it. But once the strike actually broke out, they used every means at their disposal, including the party machine, to end it. Because at that key moment when they had a choice between taking the struggle forward, challenging capitalism and restoring it, it turned out that the peaceful road to socialism that they'd been pursuing for the previous 20 years turned out to lead right back to de Gaulle, because the parliamentary road had gotten their foot in the door in the halls of power and they didn't want to give it up. A lot of their membership was based on the trade union bureaucracy. A lot of their members were trade union officials whose job it is to be professional negotiators of compromise between the interests of workers, between workers and between bosses. And so that's what they do best, and that's what they did this time. So it might seem surprising, though, that they were successful in being able to end it. It did take them 3 weeks, but they were able to do it. And they were able to do it because they had a party machine that had roots amongst the working class. For example, at the main demonstration on the first day of the strike, 1 million people marched. The Communist Party had the numbers to line up their marshals to physically separate off their members from the students, to undermine any nasty ideas that the students or the revolutionary left might sow amongst their members. They were also able to, when workers took over their workplace, then send everyone home and say, "Don't worry, job well done, guys. We'll take it from here. And that meant the strategy there was to make sure that the workers didn't come into contact with the students and the revolutionary left who'd come down to the gates of the workplace to leaflet and to talk. It also, of course, undermined any sense that the workers were in control of the situation, that they were participating in it. And finally, when the Grenelle Agreement, that's the agreement that was negotiated between the employer organisations and the trade union, when that agreement was reached and it totally failed to meet the demands that the movement had put up, nevertheless, the Communist Party was there to sell it to their members, and they used dodgy means, they used lies, they would rig ballots, they would hold meetings and lie about the outcomes of meetings that were being held simultaneously. On the railways, they forcibly started the machines, the trains, and were stopped because rank and file workers laid across the tracks and said, no, 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 we haven't decided this. Nevertheless, they were able to do it because what the left underestimated, they underestimated it then, and it comes up again and again still today, what people underestimate is that the reformist parties have a loyalty amongst workers. The Communist Party had given political workers their political education. The Communist Party had been the ones that had led strikes in their workplaces. And they weren't on such good terms with the ruling class that they didn't have to resort to fighting every now and again. And when they did, they were able to renew their left-wing cred. And so the party actually enjoyed, as bitter as the betrayal was, and that's the difficult thing to understand, that the betrayals can be terrible and yet still people grit their teeth and there is a loyalty there. Now, the left out of this internationally drew the conclusion that if revolutionaries were going to be able to combat the existing reformist organisations, they were going to have to be organised. And that's not a conclusion that, you know, that I draw here in hindsight, that authors draw, you know, in hindsight. That was real. That was the lesson, and that was apparent to people at the time as well. And so, okay. And so I don't have much time, it turns out, to talk about Italy, but that lesson was so relevant there because the Communist Party was the biggest in the world. It had 1.5 million members. And the growth of the far left is all the more remarkable because in 1968, it was pretty much non-existent to speak of. And yet, the Italy's hot autumn, which I don't have time to, you know, to talk about, you know, anything that actually happened, but suffice to say that the combativity of workers, the fact that workers, for example, set up organisations in their workplace that were to rival the existing union representative organisations that had failed them, that they had felt, you know, had sold them out on previous occasions, this gave the revolutionary left a new audience. And the main beneficiaries of it, or the group that was able to break through and attract the loyalty of young militants, was Lotta Continua, which grew to having 10,000 members by the early 70s, and to a lesser extent as well, Avanguardia Operaia. And the last point I wanted to make, though, is that the politics of Lotta Continua and SDS actually shared a lot in common. They shared in common the emphasis on spontaneity, and they shared in common the rejection of leadership per se. But the thing with Lotta Continua was that their ideas were tested out in practice a little more because they survived a little longer than SDS did. And one of the problems with the emphasis on spontaneity was that they also thought that reformist ideas would be automatically swept away in a mass revolt. And that led them to miss opportunities and times when they needed to intervene into organisations set up by the trade union movement. And unfortunately, the experience of militants is not enough to go by because their experience had been that the union organisations had sold them out all the time. So they welcomed building alternatives to it and not working in those organisations. You really had to have a theoretical understanding of the roots of reformism to be able to put yourself in a situation to try to combat it, to try to work alongside workers who were working in these organisations. And they rejected leadership per se, which led to a very high participation in the organisation. But in the end, it actually allowed the most demagogic, the most vocal, and actually intellectuals to dominate. The other thing that they shared in common with SDS was an overestimation of the struggle. The sense that revolution was around the corner led them to totally shun any talk about strategy and tactics. And that didn't help them much when the struggle cooled down a little, when it went off the boiling point. It It actually led to, within a few years, mass demoralization in their ranks. And it's no coincidence that the other thing that these two examples share in common is that a wing, both out of both of them, both actually turned toward terrorism as well, which is the politics or the strategy of born of frustration and defeat. Okay, but I don't want to leave it there. I just want to say in conclusion that the achievements of the 1960s cannot be overemphasized. The actions of ordinary people stopped the war in Vietnam. It ended segregation and posed a serious challenge to racism. Many reforms were made of universities. And in Italy, the contract that came out of the 1969 activity amongst workers was a huge victory. And so that is the achievement of the strategies of mass mobilisation. But also, I hope you take from this that the 1960s are a reminder that you should just never say that it can't happen. Because over 1 million people worldwide, because while I've just touched on a few examples, the same process was going on here, it was going on in Mexico, in other parts of Latin America, it was going on in Northern Ireland, in Western Germany, all over the world. People had dedicated their lives to the struggle and to politics. They pushed other things out of the road, their family commitments, their work commitments, their study commitments, and they said, what I do as part of the political struggle matters more than anything. And it did then, and it actually still does. Because in the fire next time, people will once again be hungry for ideas that help them change society. Now, the world, you might say that the world is very different now to what it was then. And indeed, before the 60s, people look back at the 1930s, at the Depression era and the last radicalisation, and they said, well, the world's a very different place now. We're going through an economic boom that's unprecedented in its length. And then the events of the 1960s throw all that out the window. And what I'd say is that the world today is a very different place to the factors that led to the radicalisation in the 1960s. For one thing, Iraq is much more important to the US than Vietnam ever was. And the US economy is not going through a boom. You may have noticed it's on the brink of a severe recession. And the other difference is that the Stalinist distortions that shaped the left back then are nowhere near the obstacle that they were back then. So if you take my point that it's possible for people to, at certain points, embrace radical ideas and revolutionary politics, then the job of preparing for that starts now. Because what this conference is all about is trying to set down firm foundations that mean that when people are asking us the questions about how can we change society, we can give them the kind of decent answers that they actually deserve for asking those questions in the first place.